Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Bob Hormats is the Vice Chairman of Kissinger Associates, former Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment. He joins us now in our Bloomberg 1130 studios. Bob, good to see you.
Good to be here.
As always. Let's start with this meeting in Florida. We've seen the president try to forge personal relationships with world leaders a few times now since he took office. What's going to be particularly different about this encounter in Florida?
Well, he's going to have to take the measure of President Xi Jinping, who's a very formidable, very skillful, very authoritative guy. He knows what he's doing. He's been in office for quite some time. He has a lot of power. He knows what he wants to get out of this meeting. And I think Donald Trump's going to have to do a lot of listening. He doesn't know much about China, and I suspect Xi Jinping will make a number of points about Chinese policy that may be new to Trump's ears. So I think it'll be useful. I know Xi Jinping reasonably well. I've met him a number of times. He's a very impressive person and a very strong figure, and he will be articulate in explaining China's views, where China can work with the U.S. and where China feels it can't work with the U.S. There are various areas. I think they do want to work on North Korea. They don't have as much influence as we perhaps think they do, but they do have some. Mm. They certainly want to work in dealing with terrorism. They want to work on climate to the extent Trump wants to work on climate. And they're now developing this very, very ambitious, very, I think, positive generally notion of increasing infrastructure in the region, and a lot of American companies would like to participate in this. The question is Trump going to be willing to allow that kind of participation to occur?
All right, so President Trump doesn't know China well. On whom is he relying to inform him on how the country works today?
He has some very capable people on the National Security Council staff that will do this. He also seems to be relying on his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. I don't know how
portfolio
much
portfolio gets bigger every
he
day.
Has. He has like, a big portfolio. Yeah. Now he's in Iraq. He'll be dealing with China. But there are good people on the National Security Council staff. But the State Department is not at full complement. A lot of the China experts are there in the State Department among foreign service officers, but there is not an assistant secretary for the Far East, not an assistant secretary for many other functions as well. But I suspect he'll get some good advice. But he has to listen to the advice. He has to understand the history of U.S.-China relations. And he has to measure his words very carefully because he has to be understood. And if he appears not to really understand what's going on in China, not to have any sense of Chinese history, to make statements like he has in the past, I think it will cause a lot of confusion. This is a very important meeting because almost nothing constructive will be done internationally in the world over the next 4 to 8 to 12 years without a substantial measure of U.S.-Chinese cooperation. He has to figure out a framework with President Xi Jinping for that kind of cooperation. China is very important. Americans should understand that. You can't push them around. They have strong nationalistic pressures internally in China. They won't be pushed around. The way you deal with them is to work with them in a constructive fashion. Trump's negotiating tactics may work in the real estate area. They're probably not going to work, almost certainly not going to work in dealing with China if he takes that sort of pugnacious approach that he sometimes does.
Bob Hormats, you've been party to meetings like this before. You say met the Chinese president several times as well. How do they unfold? What's going to happen here? How much is the formality going to eclipse the opportunity here for these two leaders to get to know each other on any sort of personal level?
Well, I suspect this will be somewhat less formal than the meetings
given
would
the
be
setting.
If they were in Washington, given the setting. But they have to get to know one another. And the best way of doing that is for President Trump to listen to President Xi Jinping and hear what he has to say first before weighing in with his thoughts. He can learn a lot about China from listening to President Xi and then say what he has to say. But the United States has a problem. That is, we really don't have an Asian strategy yet. We haven't put it together. Is it that we want to be tough on trade? What is our position in the on the question of the islands and the South China Sea? What is our position on Korea? The Chinese will have and do have a strategy. We may or may not agree with the strategy, but they have developed a strategy over a number of years for the region and for the world. President Xi announced a lot of that in Davos. We don't have one yet. We haven't taken the time to put one together. That puts President Trump at a disadvantage. He'll be making a number of statements, but the Chinese are going to wonder, are they part of a broader strategy or are they ad hoc? And are they going to be followed up? Are they going to be ad hoc and then change the next day or the next week, which creates a sense of unreliability and misunderstanding? Mm-hmm.
What's the worst press conference you ever had? Were you on a plane traveling somewhere and you said, geez, I wish the press wasn't here? Did that ever happen to Ambassador Hormats or
I always like the press being there because I think you normally could, on planes, have good conversations with the press on an informal, off-the-record basis and explain not just what the policy is or was, but give background. And I think it's important to have background so the press can understand not just what the policy is, but how you got there, what the basis of the policy
was. So critically, is Secretary Tillerson's policy a new policy, or do you look at it as bombing us back to John Hay or to, you know, Secretary Root or whoever?
I think he would be far better served by bringing the press along on his trips. Every Secretary of State I've traveled with, and I've traveled with seven or eight of them, have always, starting with Bill Rogers and Henry Kissinger.
You should have seen Hormats on that boat with John Hay to Panama.
Yeah, that was a lovely trip in those days. But, you know, with Secretary Kissinger and many others subsequent to Secretary Kissinger, they've always found a way of working with the press. Not the press always agrees with them or they always agree with the press, but they were able to use the fact the press was on the plane to give background information, not just the policy, but why the policy was put forward the way it was. What are the underlying reasons for the policy? What are the underlying facts? To give the press background so they can write their stories. They may agree or not agree, but at least you can give them background, get to know them. And it works very well. It always worked for me. It always worked for a number of the secretaries I've traveled with. And I think that the American people deserve to have a press traveling with the Secretary of State so they can communicate the policies more clearly and thoughtfully and with sufficient background.
Does Rex Tillerson have more of a worldview, world outlook than this White House? You talk about not having a strategy here going into this meeting with China, or at least not knowing it. Where's that strategy being devised?
I assume it's being devised primarily in the National Security Council, among National Security Council staff. But if they're wise, they will call on the experts in the State Department who know China very well. Many of them have served a long time in China. And I think they can add a great deal to the thought process that goes into putting together what the president says and putting together a strategy, if that's indeed what they intend to do. But since you don't have a lot of people at higher levels, it's become a very difficult process to put a strategy together.
Let's come back with Ambassador Hormats of Kissinger Associates. Of course, his public service to the Obama administration. Some important thoughts there, linking State Department matters into Treasury and fiscal policy. Maybe coming back, we'll talk about some of the constraints that any administration would have with the dynamics of our debt and deficit. Let's rip up the script. I mean, come on, David. You have no sleep. You know, your team won. Our executive producer's going to achieve sainthood. So let's rip up the script with Robert Hormats. Bob, the French election.
Okay.
We are distant from Chirac, Mitterrand, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. I just got an email from Anthony from Sparta. He wants to hear my French. He loved it on TV this morning. Tonight there's a debate. There's 11 people debating. 11.
Exactement.
They're becoming American-like, but they're not. You know the French are not becoming American-like.
They are not. But there is a very bright star on the French horizon, Emmanuel Macron. Macron was the economic minister in the Hollande government earlier on. I know him very well. He's a very good friend. He used to work for Rothschild. He's an internationalist. He's a fresh new face on the horizon. He's doing very well in the polls. And I do believe that if he were elected president of France, it would be a very positive boost for France and a very positive boost for Europe and for French-American relations. I think he's a new rising star and a very positive force on the French political scene.
What's the central issue here in this election? Is it a membership in the EU? Can you paint it with as broad a brush as that?
I think it's much more the economy and how to deal with the economy, how to get the economy going on a sustained basis. That would be number one. The second is how to work with the other major EU partners, assuming Merkel is reelected or at least is the head of a coalition that's reelected, maybe different from the one she has now. She would be an important partner. The Dutch have come through without moving to this populist right that some people feared. So it may well be that the rising tide of the populist right is now receding, and it would recede a lot further if Macron were elected. So I think working with the other Europeans is important, and also strengthening NATO. The French understand, I believe, that a strong NATO, a coherent EU, a strong relationship with the U.S., all are very important to the future of France, and you need someone who's pragmatic to do that. So,
bring about Angela Merkel. We last spoke, I think, before she went to the White House, and
yes,
we were talking about what you were going to be observing as all of that unfolded. I'm sure you watched it. I'm sure you listened to the press conference afterwards.
Excuse me, Ambassador Harmat, the steam was coming out of his ears so much. He was melting ice.
I was trying to be
East
diplomatic.
River.
I was trying to be diplomatic. But where does that relationship go from what we saw at the White House?
Well, what I don't understand is that Trump does not seem to have the background, the historical background, to really understand the origins of NATO, the origins of the EU, and why they're so important to the U.S. The U.S. was a great power after World War II, in part because it had a strong economy and a strong military, but it was also a great power because it developed strong alliances. It worked to strengthen European unity, which was important for stability in Europe and also to counter the spread of Soviet communism during the Cold War. Now we need Europe as a partner to deal with a number of things that Putin is doing in various parts of Europe. He's trying to undermine European cohesion, cause fragmentation within European countries and among them, and certainly in NATO. We need a strong Europe to resist that kind of thing. And that's really what he has to understand, that a strong Europe can be a big asset. If you want to make America great again, you need to have also great allies, great friendships, great partnerships. And that should be part of a Make America Great strategy, if that's the strategy he wants to pursue. But you're not going to be great if you have only a strong economy and a strong military and you have weak allies. That will not make America great again. He's got to make sure our allies are great again. Working with Merkel, working with Macron if he's elected, working with other European leaders is very definitely a part of that process, or at least should be, and they need a strategy for doing it.
Ambassador, thank you so much. Kind of you to come in today. Just so much to talk about. Just an extraordinary time, and of course, all of much more from our Washington News Bureau. Eli Lake, whose Bloomberg View column last night came out in the afternoon, percolated in the afternoon, and really blew up about 4 p.m. Last night over Susan Rice of the Obama administration requesting the names and documents that have been blacked out, had been redacted. Mr. Lake joins us right now. I know David's got some important questions. Eli, I look at the Google feed, and it's just as polarized as you would imagine. Susan Rice, unmasked Trump team. The latest wiretap bombshell turns out to be another dud. Unmasking reporter, this is bigger than Trump. That, of course, from Fox News Insider. Which is it, Eli Lake? Who should take comfort from your Bloomberg View piece?
At this point, I'm really reluctant to try to say, you know, where the story is going to end because I'm still reporting it. I think it's important for the Trump supporters to recognize that this was a unique situation after the election. There were credible allegations that that there was credible information, I should say. The intelligence community had concluded that the Russians tried to influence the election. There was an active FBI investigation that was confirmed last month into the Trump campaign to see if they collaborated in some way with the Russians in this influence operation. Susan Rice would have had to have known about that. And even though my reporting says that she was asking for information to be unmasked, or the U.S. persons to be unmasked that were affiliated with the Trump transition that did not have to do with Russia, at the same time, this is the environment, the backdrop, and it was relevant in that sense of a national security sense, particularly if we were to believe other reports from the New York Times and other places, that there was a lot of intelligence coming in after the election that did show that there were more contacts and meetings and so forth between Trump world and Russia. On the other hand, none of that has amounted to the impeachable offense of collusion. This has been stated by people like James Clapper, who was Barack Obama's director of national intelligence. And it appears that what we're learning now is that the standard for a national security advisor to ask who a U.S. person is, who is incidentally collected, there's no warrant on this person, in a routine kind of wiretap of a foreign target or a criminal target, is so loose that it pretty much you could pretty much look to see anything, and you would get your request, it appears, fulfilled, which is what happened in this National Security Council review that started, you know, under the Trump administration, of this policy known as unmasking. And that right there is something that ought to worry Democrats as well as Republicans, because right now the president is Donald Trump. He's a Republican. And if indeed, you know, the rules are so lax that you can have a backdoor loophole to go around the very strict procedures for surveilling mm-hmm. U.S. persons by going to a secret court known as the FISA court, well, then this is something that Trump could then do to his domestic opposition, and Democrats should be interested in getting to the bottom of it. And I'm actually happy to say that at least the ranking Democrats in the Senate and House Intelligence Committees are now saying that this is something worth looking into.
This is great. That's surveillance and friends. I guess that's what we'll call it, David.
Right.
We need a new couch.
Surveillance and friends.
Eli, so here's what I'm struggling with. You've got the credible information. You've got the FBI investigation. You've got the independent reporting by a number of journalism organizations. Won't there be those who say, look, this is a national security advisor looking into something that would have been of great concern? You kind of outlined this in your piece as well. There's nothing here to indicate, you were kind of alluding to this a moment ago, that Susan Rice did anything wrong or illegal. Am I right in reading that correctly?
Well, illegal, I think when I've talked to experts about this, you know the law and the procedures, I think it's legal for a national security advisor to make these unmasking requests, and the bar is very low. Improper is a different question, mm-hmm. and because this is a key point here, which I think people are missing, this is stuff that is so shrouded in state secrecy, we rarely really get much of an insight into how this process works. Every few years, when the FISA law is reauthorized in Congress, there are hearings, and the leaders of the intelligence community make a show of saying that the intelligence community takes great pains to redact the names of U.S. persons who were incidentally collected in eavesdropping and monitoring and that kind of thing. But if it turns out that a political appointee can pretty much request to unmask that information at any time, well, then it's worth finding, you know, the origins of this policy, how long this has been going on, and hopefully a sense to reform it. So I would separate the questions of illegal and improper. And if it did turn out that, in fact, Susan Rice was doing more than just asking for the information, but was spreading that around to Democrats for any kind of political advantage,
right,
or that she had something to do, and I'm not reporting this, I want to make this very clear, she had something to do with leaking the identity of Mike Flynn, who did end up in the newspaper in his phone calls with the Russian ambassador, and that forced him to resign, that did have a huge political effect, then she really is in a bit of trouble here. So I want to make it very clear that the thing that I'm reporting on right now is in and of itself, it doesn't appear to be illegal, but it may very well be improper. And I'm starting to think that the real scandal here is the fact that it's not illegal, that it may be standard operating procedure. And how long has this been going on is the question.
Can you introduce us here to a principal you mentioned in the piece? That's Ezra Cohen Watnick, a name that I don't think will be familiar to many of our listeners, but is or was wielding a pretty heavy hand on the National Security Council as an advisor to the president. Who is he? What do we know about his background, and why was he the one conducting this investigation?
Well, he's a former Defense Intelligence Agency officer. He was brought in originally by Mike Flynn. And I have to say that, you know, what he was doing was well within his remit as the National Security Council's director for intelligence, which is to review policies like this, which is when the White House, you know, what is the procedure for unmasking U.S. persons in these reports? And that's when he discovered these kinds of anomalies and then made this available to the general counsel. He is somebody who has gotten recently, you know, there's been some interest to him among, you know, sort of the progressive and liberal media. Although I have to say at this point, the argument that, you know, what he was doing is improper, I have not seen it. We're all reporting his story out, but, you know, eventually he hands the information over. The general counsel says, all right, we want you to stop the investigation at this point. He complied with that as I can report. And, you know, and kind of continued on. But the idea that it was improper to review this stuff for a policy like this, I mean, that's exactly what the director for intelligence, or what I think it's called, the classified executive secretariat, is supposed to do at the National Security Council. It's not really out of the ordinary, and, you know, and for that job, he was qualified.
What happens here next, Eli, with the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes? We've seen what you sort of characterize as bizarre behavior, him going back and forth to the White House. Obviously, this could be all tied up into that. But he's lost the confidence of some of his colleagues on the Hill. What are the next steps, do you think, for the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee?
Well, I wrote a very tough column last week because I thought that, you know, the story that he'd told the press, and specifically in an interview with me, was very misleading because he made it appear that he was informing President Trump of new information when, you know, his own White House had been, knew about it and discovered it and so forth. That said, I also understand that the chairman had his own independent sources before all of this that were telling him that there was, you know, improper unmasking going on, and that there were a number of kind of intelligence reports that were making their way to the White House that had improper details about the Trump transition. But that said, the fact that he made it appear that he was informing the president of something he didn't know, I thought was misleading and deceptive. And I did burn him on, or not burn him, I criticized him very harshly in a column last week on that. That said, the fact that now it's come out that Susan Rice had requested in dozens of occasions, you know, this kind of unmasking, in some ways vindicates his initial concerns about this, which, because it's very classified and because it's a really complex issue, and most people covering it are political reporters.
We're going to have to leave it there, Eli. Thank you so much. Really appreciate the sequence of Bloomberg View columns that we've seen from Mr. Lake. Eli Lake, writing for Bloomberg View, making national news. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. So I'm going to make this very quick because David Gura's got to get to our esteemed guest here who's taken an oath to be brief with us today. Here's the deal. Many of you know that I consider the Verizon AOL transaction to be one of the great transactions of this era by Tim Armstrong. I put it in a class with Pete Peterson's Blackstone transaction. It was just an amazing deal to bring AOL over to Verizon. Forget about that. What you need to know, David Gura, is Kelly Potter is out of Lawrence Academy playing hockey for Connecticut College. And the uproar is, Tim, nothing has changed from when you were coaching hockey at CC. North Dakota's going to get rid of women's hockey. Nothing's changed in the women's sports milieu in 20 years.
Wow. Tom, let me tell you something. First, it's great to be back here and the Lawrence Academy, Connecticut College, but more importantly, women's ice hockey. You know, I coach women's ice hockey. During, I played lacrosse there, but also in the winter, I used to coach the women's ice hockey team. And look, the bottom line is, you know, women's sports is an amazing, since Title IX,
yeah.
But there's a lot more work to be done. It's funny. We own Makers.com, which is number one women's leadership brand in the world. And I just think that the women's leadership movement right now has a lot of energy behind it. And the North Dakota situation you just brought up is exactly the type of thing that needs to get addressed
David, I was flabbergasted. Could you see them take men's basketball away from UNC? David? Would that happen?
No, it wouldn't happen.
Let's take an oath and get started.
All right. That's oath. All right, this is the rebranding. You've gotten some flack for this, the rebranding of the company here, Yahoo and AOL. Tell us a bit about the branding, what this company is going to look like. A lot of people wondering what shape it's going
to
take.
Sure. So, David, good to see you again. And one thing that we're talking about today is the launch of a new B2B name, which is essentially a house of brand supporter. We will touch about over a billion consumers once the Yahoo deal closes. We have a house of brand strategy, which is we have about 20 major brands, which include AOL, Yahoo, TechCrunch, and Gadget, Movie Phone. So we have a really big digital portfolio. And like a Berkshire Hathaway or Procter & Gamble, Oath is the name that we're taking that basically supports those brands. As a consumer, you probably won't see Oath a lot. You'll see our brand. So if you are a sports fan, you'll see Yahoo Sports. If you're a finance fan, you'll see Yahoo Finance. If you're into tech, you'll see TechCrunch. So we wanted to have a values-based brand that holds everything together. It's really the Oath is the soil that great brands grow out of. And our mission statement is build brands people love. And that's a long-term commitment. Oath is a commitment word, and that's why we decided to name the company from a B2B standpoint, Oath.
How much did this blueprint change as you're building this house of brands over these last many months? Of course, you had the Yahoo hacking. You were going through all of that. The deal was being reevaluated and changed. How has your vision for this combined company changed?
You know, the vision stayed basically the same, which is we're betting on two simple principles. One is that the world is going to get connected by software and by mobile phones. And the second is that brands are going to matter even more when that happens, because the level of noise in the world, that brands are going to continue to pop out and there's a chance to grow global brands. The Yahoo data breach that happened, I think, is something that's happened a lot to a lot of companies. Mm-hmm. It's something that Yahoo's done a great job working through, and we're focused now on basically, you know, launching the next series of great brands for the world.
Facebook, I believe, the other day did a Snapchat equivalent. Not that I'm an Tim, I'm sorry, I'm not
He's
on
not
Snapchat.
Snapping. Tom's not snapping.
I'm sorry, but help me here with how you compete with Facebook, compete with Google and the other juggernauts.
Yeah, so our strategy is interesting. So we have a different strategy than competing head-on with them. We're partners with them. So Huffington Post, which we own, is the largest distributed news source on Facebook. We have big deals with Google, with Amazon, with Apple. So we look at those, to be honest with you, I look at them as really a distribution source for our business. So we basically both put content all over those distribution sources and we monetize with them also. So I love those companies and our content people love those companies, and we're going to work in that ecosystem. We partner with everyone in the space, so we're not looking to compete. We're looking to differentiate.
Tim, how are you processing what we're seeing with YouTube right now? Obviously, you care a lot about ad revenue as well as you look to this new brand. But you see the difficulty that YouTube and Google is facing, monitoring what's being put out on YouTube. Talk about the complexity there and how you make sure that what happens there isn't happening with your brands as well.
So I think, you know, we're a brand company. We're building brands people love. So from our standpoint, we want to be in a brand safe environment and really scaled. I think the tension point you're seeing at the YouTubes and Facebook is, you know, that they're dealing with billions of consumers and trying to connect, you know, millions or hundreds of millions of videos at the same time and try to monetize them. To be honest with you, the things that have been happening recently are probably a natural outcome of the scale we face it. But the flip side of it, the silver lining is if we can solve those issues as an industry and all the companies can solve them, you know, you can either have smaller scale and not have all those problems, or you can have big scale and be connected to billions of consumers and fix that and then have a wonderful business. And I think we're, you know, heading towards the wonderful business side. But I think the advertisers are speaking. They want brand trusted environments.
20 seconds. Who's going to put Twitter out of their misery?
I think I'm a big believer in Twitter. I'm a big believer in the management team at Twitter, and very close with them. So I'm guessing that their misery is going to turn to joy at some point, and it's going to be self-resurrected from how those guys are doing and girls are doing their work.
Did you notice, David, he didn't answer that question?
That's at Tim Armstrong AOL. He's on it if you want to follow him.
Tim Armstrong, thank you so much for the oath discussion here, particularly after Insight. I'm going to tweet this out. Good morning, SiriusXM Channel 119 in North Dakota, as we looked at women's North Dakota hockey. David, why don't you bring him in? Alan Ruskin's over on the phone with the Queen of England, trying to explain weak sterling to her.
Yeah, we'll get to that in just a moment. Let me ask you about the South African rant first, if I could. We saw a piece of breaking news here, Bloomberg breaking an exclusive this morning. The head of South Africa's treasury has asked to leave his post at the end of this month, a year before his contract runs out. So it seems like we're getting compounding bad news out of South Africa here. We've seen the weakening of the rand here over these last 7 days and down 11%, I think. What's your sense of where things are going here? I mentioned the compounding. Is there more yet to happen?
There's definitely more to happen.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think we're at a little bit of a pivot point here. You know, the market, I guess, is talking about, is there some sort of Dilma moment, as it were, whereby, you know, you'd have a change in leadership and, you know, change in philosophy to some extent, or perhaps even some of the old guard coming back in, the old finance minister coming back in, seen as relatively credible, and the rand could perhaps rally substantially from here. Or alternatively, we continue on the path we've just set over the last few days, in which case, you know, dollar rand, I think, will be up well into the 14s before we know it.
I imagine you've looked at what the rating agencies have had to say here, of course, of putting South Africa on notice. What stood out to you from those commentaries?
Well, the actions have been pretty quick.
Yeah.
So, you know, look, you know, to some extent, to your earlier question, there's a lot up in the air in terms of the political direction as to where South Africa goes. And in some sense, I don't think, you know, it makes a lot of sense to change ratings right at this very moment when you can wait a few weeks and perhaps have much more information. So that is a bit of a standout. But at the same time, of course, you got, you know, what the S&P's actions already. You got, let's see where Moody's go. Is it one notch, two notches? You know, it is substantial, of course, if South Africa loses its investment grade.
Okay, help our rookie FX traders listening worldwide. Where does a guy like you enter the trade long South African rand? Strong rand, weak U.S. dollar. Does Alan Ruskin wait for a press release, a Bloomberg headline? Do you do it technically? How do you do this?
Tom, I think the South African rand is not a currency for rookies. I would say that as a warning point, you know, because this thing flies around, really. We've seen, you know, 7-8% move in roughly a week. So that tells you that certainly if you're thinking in terms of yield and carry, you don't really want to just have all your eggs in one basket in a currency like the South African rand. So that's a starting point. Right now, it's unfortunately much more of a political story than an economic story. So, you know, typically I like it more when we're reacting to data, when we're looking at the broader macro environment, which I think is still actually slightly friendly for carry. We've had a very good run for carry, but it's still, I think, slightly friendly. And the South African rand naturally lends itself to be in that basket. But right now, I'd be very cautious because, as I said, we're at a pivot, really. We could be at 13 on good political news or so-called good political news, and we could be at 14.5 quite easily in a heartbeat.
I thought there was a good piece in the Wall Street Journal this morning looking at the Chinese currency. I want to ask you a bit about that as we head to these meetings on Friday. And the lead of that piece was there's a new twist in the persistent argument that China is keeping its currency artificially low against the dollar. The yuan has actually been rising. As we head to those meetings this Friday, what are we seeing with the currency, and sort of what would the consequences be if the U.S. does in fact label a China currency manipulator?
Well, I think the U.S. has been in a tricky situation because the old story where you saw, you know, a lot of pressure for dollar China to go down and the Chinese were resistant of that, they were resistant of Chinese currency strength, kind of flipped on its head and has flipped on its head for quite a while, whereby the currency is, if anything, too weak and was weakening faster than they would have wanted. And they were trying to resist it that way around, in which case that was pretty much consistent with what the U.S. would want anyway. So the U.S. has found itself in a somewhat difficult difficult position. And I think, you know, even people who said, okay, you know, the currency, the Chinese currency is misvalued, have had to rethink. And, you know, people like the IMF, I think, said, okay, you know, we're closer to fair value here.
Deutsche Bank has led, I'll give you and HSBC credit, on a weak sterling call. If anything, you've been more aggressive about it, I'll suggest, than HSBC. You're getting to have some more company right now. Is it about weak sterling or is it about strong dollar?
A little bit of both, really. But I'd say actually, you know, if you had to put more weight, it was at least as much really on a stronger dollar story. And that is not panning out quite according to plan, of course.
Yeah, but come on.
But I think, you know, the good news, Tom, just to interrupt there, was that it's nice when you forecast currencies and you like both legs, really. So in that sense, we like both legs.
This is really important, David. Currencies, you don't talk about one currency. Right. You've heard me scream about this.
Talk about the pair.
It's about a pair. And if you get them both going in the right direction, that's where you make the alpha. That's a cardinal rule that's not said enough.
Exactly, Tom. So I think, look, I think both are going to work in that direction, i.e. sterling will be somewhat weaker in and of itself, really, and the dollar should be somewhat stronger. But it's a case of somewhat, right? I think we're, you know, looking now at dollar moves which are more contained than we would have anticipated at this point in time and given what the Fed's actually
done.
What
will be the catalyst to get strong dollar, to get the February dollar we were supposed to have be a May or June or a September dollar?
Look, I think a couple of things, Tom. I think firstly, the Fed hopefully is, you know, still more in play than the market projects. And I think that's a pretty comfortable call at this point. So we're talking, you know, rate hikes in June and September and then a balance sheet action towards the end of the year. So that is all consistent with a stronger dollar story. But we need the back end in general to play ball in all of this, right? We have to keep in mind that the 10-year has been incredibly well behaved, really. And I think if 10-year yields and the broader yield curve backs up, then, you know, the story kicks into gear with more gusto.
With the euro, with sterling, we had the speech by Theresa May. We've got an EU meeting tomorrow, again, hammering out what the process is going to be here for Brexit. How long-termist can you be on currency amidst all of the machinations that we're going to see here over these next 2 years?
Yeah, I think, you know, some people would say, look, in this respect, when you're looking at a 2-year political profile, you can actually be quite long term. But you're still reading the tea leaves. You're still trying to get a sense of, you know, is the EU 27, which is looking for the UK to first set up some sort of divorce rules before we actually come up with a new set of trade rules, or, you know, is the UK winning and we're actually doing this all in parallel kind of thing. So I think you're constantly kind of making some sort of judgment about who's got the upper hand as far as the politics is concerned.
Itay Michaeli of Citigroup. Itay, good morning.
Good morning, Tom. Good to be with you.
Did you change your auto recommendations yesterday off of 1 month's auto sales?
No, you know, our view, as you know, has been pretty consistent of mid 17 million auto sales with a peak coming in 2018, and then 16 million is our 2019 estimate. You know, last year in March, in March of 2016, we also had about a 16.5 million SAR. The full year ended up at 17.5. So these fluctuations are not that uncommon. You know, in February, we were at 17.5 million. We do see a bit more downside now as we're approaching the peak,
right?
Based on our latest work. But yesterday's number did not cause us to change our opinion. No.
As you know, there's a partial differentiation of revenue units as compared to price. And then in the auto world, there's also size of car. How critical is it that they can't sell the big cars, so they're starting to give away a lot of incentives? What does that do down the income statement?
Sure. So the companies we cover, like Ford and GM, we think the majority of profits in North America come from the pickup truck segment. And pickups, we think, has actually a very unique supply-demand imbalance. We have seen, Tom, pricing pressure in sedan segments, even crossover segments now since last year. So some of this incentives rising, affordability headwinds are natural later cycle pressure points that we see. Why did GM confirm their 2017 guidance last week in spite of all the negativity that we read about around the auto sector? Because the pickup trucks have a unique supply-demand imbalance, and we think that continues. And that's why, despite calls for peak auto for the past 3 years, right? 3 years, profits in North America for domestic OEMs like GM and Ford have been strong. So I think the pickup truck story is frankly highly overlooked in this whole debate about the cycle.
How worried are you about the glut? You've got a glut of new vehicles, a glut of old vehicles, and you got companies here who are trying to reinvent their product lines. It seems like that's a recipe for a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I mean, you are seeing off-lease volume, again, pretty natural this later point in the cycle and some affordability headwinds. The report we published actually last night, we were kind of making the argument that if you look at affordability historically, even if you account for some of the pressures that are incrementally occurring, we don't think we're in some sort of an uncharted territory in terms of monthly payments and auto sales and how they relate to the current macro economy, the consumer confidence, disposable income. So we don't think we're in some sort of an uncharted territory. But yeah, at this kind of seventh, eighth inning of the cycle, you should start to see some pressure points in select segments. And kind of our point is, all that's been happening and all that's been absorbed, but the pickup truck story, which is the anchor for earnings, again, the majority, we think, of GM and Ford, it does not get the attention it probably deserves. A lot of times people equate it to housing or oil, and we think it's a much bigger story than that.
Etienne McCauley, Citigroup with us. We continue. Etienne, I did a chart of used car inflation, price change, if you will. We're beginning to see some real price erosion year over year in used cars. How linked are the equity shares of the big auto companies to used car dynamics?
I mean, there's certainly some exposure from a lending perspective. We saw Ford had an impact late last year.
Well, I need to interrupt because this is so important. I'm sorry, I didn't get into my puny brain. Do you agree with Steve Eisman that there is a subprime auto challenge in the markets?
I mean, we have seen delinquencies generally rise. I mean, we haven't seen data on subprime delinquency that seems kind of, again, as an outlier relative to the past. There's been a lot of articles written about subprime lending being pulled back in the fourth quarter, which is fine. We want to see rational lending behavior. So what we're looking for is, if there is a problem, if there is a higher delinquency rate in subprime, we want to see the industry kind of pull back on that. There's been a lot of reports that that did occur in the fourth quarter. Because what the market, the equity prices of these companies want to see, Tom, is they want to see different behavior than prior cycles. They want to see production cuts if sales are weaker. Production cuts are okay to maintain lean inventory. They want to see subprime lending, to your question, kind of get pulled back if that becomes an issue. And that's what we think is the bigger story. Because these stocks, like if you look at GM, earnings going from $3 to over $6, they don't really have an earnings problem. They have a multiple problem on their equity prices. And I think part of it is, how will these companies react in a post-peak environment to some of these kind of natural pressure points that occur? But no, we've not been of the view that there's some sort of an auto bubble there for lending. Although at this point in the cycle, you do tend to see these pressure points.
What's the financing picture look like to you quickly? We'll come back and talk more in a moment. In the last 30 seconds we got here before the break, how's the financing picture look?
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, we've seen delinquencies kind of move up a little bit. The used car pricing pressure is having a bit of an impact. If you're long pickup trucks, which has a lot less leasing than sedans, we think you're in better shape, which is why in our selectivity we prefer the max pickup exposure that you can find. But generally, yeah, we're seeing what you would typically see at this stage later on in a cycle. But as the last cycle proved, used vehicle prices strengthened very quickly after the last recession because car density came down quickly. So there's some natural hedges here in terms of the cyclical exposure.
With Etienne McCauley of Citigroup, thrilled to have him on today after the shock yesterday of the auto report. We'll continue with Mr. McCauley and talk about individual securities here in a moment.
Etienne, I want to ask you about what we heard from David Einhorn of Greenlight Capital last week, a proposal that he made for a new share structure for GM. How did you react to what he's proposed on the heels of that announcement? What more information do we have about how that might play out and what management thinks of it?
Rating agency said that there would be a risk of GM's credit ratings falling below investment grade, which would be a serious issue at this stage of the cycle for any company. So we don't really have a formal view, but what we wrote in our note is that the root of the GM problem is a perception problem tied to pickup trucks, and believe it or not, technology and the real opportunity they have to take their loss-making car business, we think, into something that's much better. In the past, buybacks and dividends and certain things were not really helpful to the stock. And we don't have a view on the latest proposal, but I think the rating agencies were the key voice here. We have to kind of see how this plays out. But what we really wanted to focus on was the root of the problem, which is a perception problem that we think is really the cause of where valuations stand today.
Help me with some fact-checking here. We've heard from the CEOs of GM and Ford. They've made some moves perhaps not in light of what the president has said or asked them to do, but they've decided to keep some factories here, move some production here to the U.S., and that's been in the works for a long time. Something that struck me when I heard Mark Fields talk after one of these news items was this is something that made financial sense. It didn't have anything to do with politics. Is there a truth to that? And if that's the case, why did it take the company so long to do what it's done?
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's something we wrote about even last night, that what we're watching for is how does the industry react as auto sales plateau? And we talked in the last segment about some of the pressure points that you're seeing. And certainly, you know, one of the questions we've gotten from investors over the past few years is why are automakers adding capacity when auto sales are plateauing?
Yeah.
When you see companies take that back, yeah, you kind of score a point for rational behavior, which is exactly what you want to see at this point of the cycle. So yeah, there's a lot of capacity coming in, and we have to watch that very carefully.
Okay, I got to look at a chart. And if I want to look at a long-term chart, I got to afford, because they're the only ones that didn't go out of business. I guess I could look at the Europeans as well. Sell me here on why, as an institution or a long-term retail investor, I want to own these dogs. I mean, they're cyclical. 6% total return for Ford in the last 10 years. Help me here. Are they going to become like the airline stocks where they grow up and finally deliver massive cash flow? Or is it the same old cyclical story of metal benders in Detroit?
Sure. So to be clear, you know, we don't recommend Ford. We're neutral on Ford, have been for the last few years. But GM, we do recommend $51 price target. And here's the thing, that most of the profits here come from a segment that is bigger than it's been in many, many years, pickup trucks. Three players have over 90% market share. Think about how fragmented the global automotive industry is. And you have these companies, and this is why we're seeing earnings confirmations in spite of all the pressure points we talked about in the last segment. At the same time, you have, I think, what is an overlooked, let's call it a self-help story over the longer term, where you know, a lot of talk today about autonomous and shared mobility, connected cars. We do a lot of work on this, and a lot of investors tend to, you know, rightfully focus on the suppliers who will provide content on these more advanced vehicles. But there's not as much attention on who the future mobility providers, and specifically the mobility networks of tomorrow, are going to be. And we think that in the automaker space, there's going to be some select opportunities, winners and losers. And we think GM is one of those opportunities.
Help me here, though, with their GM dividend payout ratio. They got $5, $6, $7 gazillion in free cash flow. They're running it like they did 30 years ago. When do I get a real dividend payout from these people?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're paying out a pretty healthy dividend of, you know, about $2.5 billion per year. They're buying back stocks. They've got a pretty tight capital allocation policy in terms of all free cash flow going to shareholders. And you know, they're investing in this year an incremental $600 million just in autonomous technology alone. So we actually were seeing investment, and we're seeing some pretty decent kind of capital returns.
Thank you so much. Itay Michaeli with us with Citigroup. Greatly appreciate it. On the auto, this is what we love to do. This is what surveillance is about. Jamie Butters one day, who's a genius on the whole Detroit thing, and then an expert like Mr. Michaeli. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.